one-year-old officer, and I am the Honorary Secretary of SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next programme talk will be on Solvency II appraisal value. This talk will take place on Tuesday, the 6th of March, and further details and online registration is available on SIAS's website. On the subject of online registration and charging for non-members, tonight's talk is our second talk since introducing these changes. We're eager for this process to run as smoothly as possible and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have on this subject. Please do email us. There are also forms outside which you can fill in afterwards if you'd like to provide feedback to us that way, and there's a jar you can put it in. And regarding socials, unfortunately, the escape room social is now fully sold out, but we do have a poker tournament on Wednesday, the 14th of March. So for those of you interested in the poker tournament, please do have a look online as well. It is usually quite competitive. The attendance and registration for CPD is also working in a new way, in that you saw the program guy standing outside there asking you to register. If you've not yet registered and put your ARN and signature next to your name and ticked it off, you won't be eligible for CPD, so please ensure that you do that. If a fire alarm sounds during the meeting, this is not a test, so please exit at the back of the hall. And finally, a reminder to switch all your mobile phones to silent. Now back to tonight's talk. The talk will last around an hour and will be followed by Q&As with a speaker. If you do have a question throughout the talk or anything like that, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contributions, so there has been a change in that we offer the best contribution. A champagne prize is on offer for the best contribution, both by a student member of the IFOA and also the best contribution from any fellow of the IFOA, regardless of the number of years post-qualification. So please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions. And then finally, there will be some sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall afterwards. Please do join us for this. Unfortunately, one of our speakers, Margaret de Valois, has had to cancel at short notice due to unforeseen events. Margaret has sent her apologies, and we hope that she'll be able to present at one of our future SIAS events. Nevertheless, I'm very pleased to introduce Philip Doggett, who will present this evening's talk on applying actuarial skills to public sector politics. So Philip is an actuary, currently working for the IFOA, but only for another week. Previously, he's worked for a number of insurance companies and pension consultancies. He is also a conservative councillor for the Collinton or Fairmilehead ward, I hope that pronunciation is okay, in Edinburgh City Council. So on that note, Philip, I'll hand over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. If we maybe depart from the usual format of these things, that if you do want to ask a question as you go along, then please just indicate in the usual manner and I'll ignore you. We can have questions as we go along. It might make it a little bit more fluid, possibly more interesting as well, dare I say. First of all, a couple of caveats. This was not my idea. This talk was Margaret's idea. Margaret has undertaken some work for Cornwall County Council, chairing their remuneration committee. And we were speaking about 6 months ago, and when she heard that I'd been elected to the council, she says, well, that's quite interesting, and she explained what she did. And she said, I've got an idea for this talk. And very foolishly, in a moment of weakness, I said, well, if you wanted to do a joint presentation from someone who provides a service to a local authority to someone who sits on a local authority, then I'd be up for that. So if I hadn't agreed to that, tonight would have been off. So maybe that's not a bad thing. Just a couple of caveats as well. I did stick in a couple of extra slides last night when I knew that Margaret wasn't going to be here, primarily to fill in a little bit of time. But it's something that I knew that some of you at least, if not all of you, would have had questions to ask. I wanted to avoid them. but I suspect I'll probably not be able to avoid questions around the topic, given I've now included them in the slides. And the final thing I need to say in terms of an introduction is, if I say we at any stage, please forgive me for that little bit of political bias. I know we're in Staple Inn, and I should be as neutral as possible, but when you're talking about your responsibilities as an elected member of a council, sometimes it's a little bit easy to forget what is going on. Yep, they're my views. Can I also say they're not the views of my party or my colleagues on the council, as well as not being the views of Staple Inn Actuarial Society. So four things I want to look at in terms of how you would apply actuarial skills in politics, effectively. First of all, looking at the campaign, and I'll just gloss over that because that's the thing that people tend to ask questions about. It's probably the least relevant in terms of actuarial skills, but you'll probably want to ask one or two questions about that, so I've stuck that in. The election itself, that there will be a graph and a table of numbers, you'll be glad to know, so I'm not sure if that makes it technical for CPD. It's perhaps not as technical as the Solvency II analysis you will get next time, but I won't make any apology for that. The little bit of stuck in is the general election 2016. Everyone has an opinion on it. I will maybe offer you some limited opinion in terms of, dare I say, what went wrong. Some of you might say what went right, which is fine. And finally, and probably the most important bit, is actually the role of a councillor. What can an actuary bring to the party in terms of what's going on in my case, the City of Edinburgh Council? So there will be a lot of Edinburgh-flavoured mentions, and I do recognise one of our party members from Edinburgh in the audience, so I will be in trouble if I say anything bad. He'll report back. Anyway, never mind. But there will be things there that you will be able to ask. But I hope that it will give you an indication in terms of the examples it gives of what life is like as a councillor and also as an actuary. So the campaign, first of all, why get involved? Which is the first question that people ask me when I say. Two reasons. Well, probably three. One, I've always been interested in politics. As you can tell from my accent and from the other side of the Irish Sea, as you can tell from my rough age, politics was a very interesting part of life when I was growing up as a boy, as a teenager. It's always been there, and that has carried into adult life in terms of just understanding what politics is like and the impact it can have on people's lives. So that's been always there, whether dormant or quite lively. That's been different at different stages. Second reason for getting involved, I am leaving the employment of the IFOA next week, but I've been working in the policy team for the last 5 and a bit years. And it's very difficult when you're working in a policy team really not to become more and more interested in politics, really understand what's happening within government, what are the issues that Westminster, Whitehall are thinking about that affect the actuarial profession. And I know that there are one or two faces in the audience that have had a little bit of contact with me in terms of the work that we have produced as a policy team, some very good, some less good, some big impact, some no impact whatsoever. But when you're in that environment, it's very difficult to avoid being really interested in what is going on. I think the first time I came to Staple Inn for an event after I was employed, the then pensions minister, and I think he's about 5 pensions ministers ago now, Steve Webb, was the guest speaker of the morning session. I don't know if anyone was here. But Steve gave an excellent presentation and bizarrely said, standing from this lectern, I feel at home here, which made me worry for the man's sanity. But anyway, that was a politician wanting to be an actuary and not the other way around. And the third thing, why did I get involved? And this is really sort of raw politics. Anyone who lives in Scotland, or even those of you who live south of Hadrian's Wall, can't help but notice that there has been a little local discussion taking place over the last 5-6 years about the future of Scotland's constitutional position, either inside or outside of the United Kingdom. And it was impossible living in Scotland in the run-up to the 2014 referendum not to have an opinion. Everyone had an opinion on the referendum, and I think the fact that you had a ridiculously high turnout was an indication that it had enthused the population way beyond any other political issue. I don't think I will ever see it again in my lifetime, just in terms of the involvement of the whole country. From the smallest to the oldest, everyone was talking IndyRef 2. IndyRef. Some people are still talking about IndyRef 2. So everyone really was involved. I remember the night of the referendum, my then 9-year-old daughter said, "So what are we going to do if it's a yes vote?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. Can always, with the job I had, we could just move to London. Everything would be fine." And her wise big sister said, and I apologise to anyone of this national extraction, was she said, "Well, we could even move to Wales." I said, "No, we're okay. We're not in that stage yet." But anyway, that was a teenager's view of the world back then. But obviously that enthused, I think, a new generation, even an older generation of people who were to get involved. One thing I did mean to ask. I don't want to know your affiliation. Is there anyone here who's a member of a political party? A few. Some hands higher than another. Anyone who's active in terms of knocking on doors? And has anyone stood for election? Were you successful standing for election? Oh, are you a current councillor? Excellent. I look forward to the sandwiches. Not the questions yet. Selection process. It's weird. It's weird. Every party, I think, has the same problem in terms of getting people to stand for selection. You prepare your most momentous speech you've ever written in your life. You speak for 5 minutes, and in my case, the 7 voting people in the room decide which of the 5 impeccably behaved candidates they wish to select for their election. It is as bad as that. Now, I know in some wards there are lots of people, some wards there aren't very many, but I think it's perhaps one of the issues. Getting people actually out to vote for their selection in the selection process is a major issue. And there is a danger then, in my view, that local associations of any party can start to lose control of what's going on, and you then get candidates being imposed from on high. Just a personal view, but it's something that does affect all political parties. So the selection process, I've stuck it there because it's necessary, but you sort of set your stall out in terms of what you're going to do for your ward or your constituency. So we have a question at the back. There were some people in the room who weren't eligible to vote because they didn't live in the ward, but they were there for other reasons. Some people came to observe the process because they were going to go through their own process in their own ward, but there were only 7 voting people. Correct. That's not the case. Well, the neighbouring ward, there were 40 people voted in the selection process, so it is a wee bit different. It's not a challenging thing, necessarily. I know it depends on where you live and what party and the strength of the party in the ward, but it wasn't difficult. That was my second go at it, because I stood in my own ward where I live, first of all, and I said, that's the one I want the be represented in. But of the 7 voting members in that ward, 3 were related to one of the other people. So the numbers were against me, but anyway, never mind. That happens as well. But anyway, and a very fine and able councillor, She is too. She is a good friend, so I can't say that. The doorstep. This time last year, what time are we at? Just after 6 o'clock, I had a bunch of leaflets under my arm and I was doing what I had to do. It was a challenge because you've got limited time when you're working to go out and knock on all these doors. We always sent out notifications of where the different candidates were campaigning during the week, and it was always written as such and such a candidate and their team will be campaigning, meet at such and such a place at 6 o'clock. There was one night I met the chairman of the Scottish Conservatives just after 6 o'clock. He was coming out of the bar of his golf club. I'm not quite sure how that tallied with everything else. And he said, "Oh, are you out tonight?" And I said, "Yes." And I said, "Plenty to do." And he said, "And you're out with your team." As he surveyed the wide open road with only one person out knocking on doors. And I said, "Yes, my team has got full attendance tonight, and we're out doing it." Again, the loneliness of an election candidate, particularly in local government. The doorstep. So what about the doorstep? First of all, listen to the concerns, which are almost always going to be local. So Collins and Fermile Head ward can safely be described as perhaps the most middle-class part of Edinburgh in terms of the ward. As a whole, there is one area where there is some deprivation, but again, the level of deprivation is not as bad as parts of the north of the city, where it is a lot worse. So there are very limited social problems in that ward. It's very comfortable, very middle class, at least 2.5 cars in every driveway or spilling out onto the roads. Actually, I should have mentioned cars as well. Anyway, that's another thing. And the concerns were, my bin is not collected on time. If you lived in Edinburgh, everyone says that. Okay, that's an Edinburgh thing, really bad. The roads have got potholes, and don't talk to me about potholes currently because we've had a really cold winter up north. I know it's cold here today, and you're all feeling that, but it's been like this, except worse, in Edinburgh for about a month. It's been absolutely Baltic. And the roads now have quite amazing geographical additions to them, like hills and valleys that aren't supposed to be there. But we live with that. And if you know anything about Edinburgh, the one topic that will arouse passions even greater than independence, the trams. Our trams, which were supposed to cost something like 300 million, ended up costing a billion. The inquiry into the trams, which is still on running, has now hit the £10 million cost, which is greater than the cost of the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq invasion. And we're paying for this. So as the trams in Edinburgh are not quite like the trams in Croydon or Manchester that take you to places, we don't have a network of trams in Edinburgh. We have a line which takes you from the airport to the city centre. It wasn't even finished the first time around. Although from the airport to the city centre, that previously was known as the number 22 bus route. So we've paid £1 billion for a bus replacement. That's one bus replacement. So you can imagine that for the people of Collington, Fermile Head, who live at least 4 miles at the nearest point to the closest tram stop, it's an issue. National trends, depending on your timing, you sometimes get national issues kicking into local politics. Now, I've said anyone but the SNP, except the SNP supporters, but that was it. That was all I heard in terms of national issues until, very inconveniently, the Prime Minister decided to call a general election halfway through the local election campaign, which every local councillor was delighted to hear about because it meant you had an extra 3 weeks campaigning after you'd finished your own campaigns. Great for the step count, not great for everything else. So national trends, sometimes there, mostly not, but because of the nature of Scottish politics, although this is, will continue to diminish over time, that independence issue was there. So what do? You listen to the people on the doorstep, you're gathering lots and lots of information, you're feeding the forms back to the local office who type all the information in, build up a picture of the electorate. So then we need to start thinking about, well, what happens if you're elected? And what happens in the very unlikely event for us that the Conservatives were going to form part of the administration in the city? So the three things that you really needed to start looking at were, are there any citywide or indeed localised solutions that can help solve some of the problems? And in true actuarial fashion, the answer is yes, no, and maybe. There are some solutions that can be introduced for example, bin collection. We are undergoing a pilot system in Edinburgh at the moment where all the refuse collection lorries have a tracker in them, so they know exactly where the lorries are. Why you wouldn't know where your lorry was anyway is a separate issue, and let's not go there because of something on the go about that. Quite worrying, but never mind. So this tracker can identify where there are problems with routes and hopefully identify better routes. And we're going to get a report on that in the near future on the pilot. But you've also got limitations in terms of what you can do with your party. Obviously, your party members, even though it's very localised issues are key, you have to take into account what's coming down from on high. Now, most of the time, it's not a problem, but occasionally you might find local issues that create problems. So after the elections, the biggest issue in Scotland was in the city of Aberdeen, which is even colder than Edinburgh, if you've been, where there was a hung council. The Labour group decided they would go into administration with the Conservative group, and they were immediately suspended by the party leader in Scotland because she... The then leader, now celebrity, Kezia Dugdale, decided that that wasn't really the way to go. So there can be party limitations on that. And when you see the numbers of the council, you understand where our limitations came from in Edinburgh. And then you start to look at manifesto options. Again, it's localised. It has to meet the needs of the city. So unsurprisingly, bins, roads and trams featured very highly in our manifesto. No trams, fix the roads and better bin collections. As you can see, there's a lot of actuarial analysis went into that, but that was we thought that the people wanted, so we have to give them it. But actually, they were the biggest problems facing the city. You say, where are schools? In Edinburgh, 25% of children are privately educated. And some of you will go, wow, how do you afford that? Because the fees are a lot lower than privately educated kids pay. Sorry, the parents of privately educated kids pay in London. It's affordable. So for a lot of actuaries, lawyers, accountants, the first option is education. So it's not as big an issue. Doesn't mean to say that we don't have education problems. We do, because we have schools falling down in Edinburgh. And unfortunately, a girl was killed by a wall that collapsed in a school. So there were major issues around the construction of schools over the last decade. And there was a significant report produced on that last year. So what are the solutions? So we come up with manifesto commitments. No trams, schools I've mentioned, healthcare. I know it's different in every part of the United Kingdom, but one of the, I think, the best policies that was introduced by the government in Holyrood was a plan to integrate health and social care. Now, the IFOA has done quite a lot of work around the provision of care in later life, and I know the policy papers are on the IFOA's website that you can look at. We have a real problem in terms of people living longer and then starting to suffer multiple conditions. Those of you with parents or grandparents who are at that stage of life, they don't have one thing that's wrong with them. They have a lot of things that are wrong with them, and they need proper care provision, particularly at the last stages of life. And for the first time, there was a lot of thought given to how that health and social care provision should be unitised. And a lot of it was given to the local authorities to sort out, working alongside the NHS. Unfortunately, it's been a shambles. And no one seems to be doing anything of value on that. And I can touch on part of the reasoning behind that. I will say that the most successful local authority that seems to be doing some work on this is in Manchester, producing some really good results in terms of how they've restructured the provision of care. And we're now starting to see one or two things in Scotland to develop in terms of looking at the problem. So if you've got someone with multiple conditions who really they don't want to be running up and down the hospital every day of the week, what's the best way of treating them? Bring all the doctors to one place and let the people who need the medical care see all the doctors they have to see at one time. And we're starting to see that being introduced in the Borders and in the Highlands. Incidentally, rural areas where there are lots of challenges with transport, but they've come up with an innovative solution. Now, I think there are lots of innovative solutions that can be developed around healthcare in terms of how you look after the oldest living in society, and there's stuff to do there. National developments, we had a gift coming up to the election. The last thing you do as a national government is alter your council tax bans just before the election. And the way council tax was set up in Scotland, effectively the wealthiest areas were paying extra money into an educational attainment fund. So Edinburgh suffered a massive increase in council tax, and for some people it was 27%, just because the government in Holyrood changed the bandings. So knock on the door and say, have you got your council tax bill yet? Vote for us. Easy. Promised no council tax rise above what the national government had introduced, and it was a vote winner. Simple. And again, NDREF 2, I've mentioned that, and I'm not going to go on about it. Right, the actuary's worst nightmare. Let me indulge in some stereotypical assessment of you. Knock on doors. You know, that's not good, because there might be someone on the other side of the door. And even worse, if they open it, you have to talk to a stranger. Now, I imagine for a lot of us, that's pretty bad. You wouldn't do it. Actually, if you did it for no good reason, you would probably get arrested. But anyway, that's a separate issue. I was allowed to do it. And you didn't know what they were going to say. Some of them were very nice. One or two weren't. The most effective protest I saw was as I put a leaflet through a door one night. The gentleman opened the door, marched down the path to where his bin was, ripped the leaflet up, opened the bin, threw the leaflet in, looked at me, and I said to him, good evening. And that was it. So sometimes you have to smile. But actually, the thing that I find worst of all, street stalls. You're standing around waiting for someone to come and talk to you, or even worse, going to go and accost someone, because at some stage you needed a photo op to put in your next leaflet to show that you were out on a street stall. I still hate them. They don't say anything, but I really do hate them. Anyway, okay, I'm only joking. Actually, actuary skills, I think actuary skills are very useful on the doorstep. If you get an engaged resident, they will tell you all the things that are wrong with the city. They will tell you how the city needs to reassess its finances, how it should be spending the finances, and of course everyone's different. So they will have a range of issues that they will throw at you, but actually that's something that actuaries have no problem with. Dealing with many variables, and trying to use those within effectively what's a finite budget. Now, a doorstep question or discussion like that is pretty straightforward. But you do need to think on your feet. And again, actuaries are very good at thinking on their feet. Actuaries are also very good at presenting solutions. Most actuaries do that. I had a conversation with Martin White just before he came in, and he said to me, "Oh, we really downplay actuaries' skills, particularly in communication." And I'm 100% agreement with Martin. We have painted ourselves as a profession that can't communicate. With due respect, if you hold that view, you're talking rubbish, because we take a lot of very, very difficult technical information and we present that information in a way that the listener will understand in almost all cases. I know there are things that can be improved. You can always improve your communication. That can never be minimized. But as a profession, as a whole, we have done very well in presenting lots of complicated issues in a way that people can understand. I don't think we should diminish that. And those skills can be applied in so many areas of life. Anyway, enough of the doorstep. The election. Nothing can be done. That's rubbish. I just stuck this in to tell you what it was like on the day. You think the candidate sits back and does nothing? No. You've got to put A boards up at polling stations. Well, your team does that. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm the team. You've got to make personal appearances at polling stations because people like to see the candidates. I don't think anyone has ever been persuaded to change their vote because a candidate has been at a polling station. You have phone calls. What's worse than knocking on someone's door? It's phoning them up. You've got that list of names. And, of course, when you're phoning them at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there's no one in. So, you know, after 20 phone calls, it becomes a bit frustration. And then your foot knock up. People say you can't do any canvassing on election day. Well, actually, you can ask people, have they voted? Do they need a lift? You're just being helpful. Remind them that the election is on. Yes, I know, sometimes you do. Local government in particular, you definitely need to remind them that the election's on and just encourage people to turn out. So it's not a relaxing day for candidates. It's pretty rubbish, actually, because it's a very long day. At the general election, my daughter, who's now studying politics and had been doing some crazy stuff during the election campaign, we went out for a dawn leaflet run at a 4:45 in the morning. Wasn't even my ward. I don't know why I was doing it. But anyway, 4:45, and we got to bed at 6:30 the next morning when we got home. So there's lots to do. That's actually the wrong title of the slide. It should really be the count. Edinburgh City Council is very kind to its candidates. It counts the next day. So you can actually have a good night's sleep, which is very pleasant. The only thing I can compare it to everyone above a certain age is, do you remember the times when you used to get your exam results posted out to you? And you were listening for the thud or the gentle waft of the envelope as the results come through the letterbox, the thud indicating that it was time to fill in your resit form. The gentle waft of the envelope suggesting that everything was hunky-dory and you could finish work at about 9:30 to adjourn for the rest of the day. Well, it's like that. It's awful. Absolutely awful. In Edinburgh, they count two wards at a time, which is fine, and it's reasonably efficient, except when you're ward 8, you're sort of hanging around for a little while and your friends are getting elected. Oh, great. Fantastic, really happy for you. Well, you are, but the worst thing is you're taken into a room by the returning officer with your agent, except my agent couldn't go there because he was in with another candidate in a different room. So I had somebody else's agent come in with me. And you sit on chairs, not dissimilar to these chairs, set up in a little circle, obviously some mutual society trying to discuss each other's problems, except you're not. You're just about to find out whether you're elected or not. And what they do is they read out the number of votes cast as first preferences. So we have multi-member wards in Scotland, so it's a single transferable vote. So in our ward, 3 candidates were elected, 6 of us went into the room, and you're just sitting there waiting for someone to tell you how many first preference votes you got, which of course means nothing, unless you've sailed through the quota on the first count. And then they tell you who's elected. And you're just sitting waiting for it. It is absolutely horrific. And I cannot explain how painful it is. It's even worse than standing up here. Anyway, I said I promised you a graph. So here we go. On the left-hand side is the first preference votes. So I've color-coded the charts so you can get some party significance. As I said, Collinton Fermile Head is a very comfortable ward. So there were two Conservative candidates. We had two councillors from 2012 to 2017. So we were putting two up again. As you can see, my colleague Jason Rust scraped home on the first count. I was sitting in fourth place, about 600 votes behind Labour and the SNP. The SNP candidate was the sitting councillor. And you can see then the progression of votes throughout the rest of the counts. So on count two, I surged into second place with the lead of about 100. Then count three, the Green candidate was eliminated and her votes were transferred to, not me, dare I say. Actually, no, that is true. I did see some ballot papers as they were coming out, Green won, Doggart too. Okay, well, what's going on there? Someone doesn't understand what's going on. But anyway, I must have knocked on their door and spoken to them, maybe even smiled. So we had that redistribution for on the third graph. On the fourth, the Lib Dem candidate was eliminated. The transfer of his votes took the Labour councillor across the quota. And then when his votes were reallocated, as you can see, I thrashed the sitting councillor by the grand total of 12 votes. I'm just glad I hadn't seen that the whole way through the process. You just see the first preference votes because that would have made that day even worse and longer. So anyway, there's the graph. It's out of the way. You've got a graph. I think that counts as CPD. Right, the aftermath. So what have we got? We won on one. We won on the popular vote, which was something like 29%. The SNP won in seats. They had 28%. That's never mentioned in the council chamber, that we got more votes than the SNP. What we ended up with, and this was fun, or it continues to be fun, is a minority SNP-Labour coalition. Now, I didn't put total at the bottom because I wanted you to test your brains. We have 63 councillors in Edinburgh, if I've done that right. And we have 31 councillors in the administration. Now, you can then work out that you have 32 opposition councillors. If we get things right, trying that simple task of getting Tories, Lib Dems and Greens all to vote together, we can defeat the administration. So my last bit of point is every vote counts. Now, that becomes quite important, as you can imagine. We have had a drawing of lots. Unfortunately, our group leader's drawing of lots was akin to England's performance in penalty shootouts against Germany. So he needs some training on how to pick out a high number from the bag. But it's interesting how this works. And what makes it even more interesting is that within the Labour group, there are some of them who, let me put it mildly, they hate the SNP. Hate them with a passion. And that is putting it mildly. Some of the Labour councillors have refused paid positions within the administration, so they wouldn't chair any committees or anything like that because they won't do it. And we're just hoping that we might get a defection at some stage because that will alter the balance. But we'll see. Every vote counts. We can really challenge. And if you get the Greens on side, and we're just starting to work out how you do that, because we've put up Green motions that they voted against, and we've put up non-Green motions that they voted for. we're still trying to work that one out, but that So it also means that on committees, where the work's really done, and I'll come on to that, again, the administration does not have a majority on committees, which makes it very difficult for them. And were they not political opponents, I might even have a modicum of sympathy for them. Right, I stuck this in last night because I thought, oh, people are going to ask me about this. Right, this is the bit where I have to repeat, these are my views, they're not the views of the party, they're not the views of the party leadership, not the views of the party in Scotland. Caveat, caveat, caveat. Right. Timing. If you have a 20% lead in the opinion polls, that's a pretty good time to call a general election. Because parties do not lose elections when they've got 20% leads in opinion polls. However, we had some problems. First of all, the campaign duration was far too long. If you have a 20% lead in the opinion polls, you do not go for a six-week campaign. You go for a three-week campaign, which is the shortest you can have. If you have a 20% lead, there's only one way the polls are going to go. It's all downside risk. So to have a campaign that lasted 6 weeks was crazy, especially a campaign that coincided with part of the local elections campaign. And I know timing of elections is slightly unusual in England. Some people have them, some people don't. But in Scotland, everyone voted in a local election. So that was bizarre. Manifesto. I think there's one thing that we learned from the manifesto. You don't change the policies that you've written in it, even if people hate them. So when the manifesto was published on Thursday, and by the Monday we had a U-turn, we had an issue, a major issue, and it wasn't the policy. The issue was that the policy had changed. As I've already mentioned, health and social care is a problem that's not going away. It's causing us problems as a profession, trying to find solutions for the provision of proper care for the very oldest. So it was a starting point. To change the policy was a disaster, absolute disaster, because the focus then was not on the policy. Policies define the leader, and if you change policies, you're effectively changing the leader. Now, what was the slogan that Mrs. May used throughout the election? Please repeat after me. Strong and stable. Strong and stable. But you've just changed your policies after 3 days of publication. All of a sudden, the issue wasn't the policy, it was whether Theresa May was a strong and stable leader. And that was a disaster. Because the focus then became her leadership, and that was the challenge, major, major challenge. So the Prime Minister, two things I would learn from that. Again, I will emphasise their personal thoughts. Always have a leadership election to find out who your party leader should be. So Theresa May has some great strengths, but she also has some very evident weaknesses, and they were highlighted in the general election. But because she had never gone through a national election campaign, i.e. who would be leader, those weaknesses weren't highlighted. They were hidden away. If those weaknesses had been up front during the leadership campaign, one of two things would have happened. Either she would have lost the leadership election, or she would have won the leadership election, and then the party could have done something to work with Theresa May's character, personality, and how she was viewed. I think that is a really straightforward analysis of what the problem was. And you do not run a presidential campaign, which we did, with a non-presidential leader. The one thing about the American election of 2016 is that you had probably the two most detested candidates ever. I think the reason why Trump won was because more people detested Hillary than detested Trump. No one voted for them, really, because it was disastrous. They shocking candidates and political pygmies compared to what we've had in the past in most elections. But the thing about Trump is, whether you agree with him or whether you're not, is he's charismatic. He will polarize opinion, but he will get his own people on side. He gets his own people on side, they will come out and vote for him. And they did, which was why Trump won. But in the UK, we had a presidential campaign with probably the least presidential member of the cabinet. If I say Boris, well, most of you will be London-based. You'll have strong opinions on Boris as the mayor. Boris is also a polarising figure. You either love him or hate him. But if you love him, you'll vote for him. Which is part of the reason why Margaret Thatcher was such a successful prime minister. People loved her, hated her, but the people who loved her came out and voted for her. Alongside that, the presidential campaign, Mr. Corbyn, leader of the opposition, is a great campaigner. One of the best campaigners that the Labour Party has. I don't think they realise that, but a six-week campaign with a presidential leader right up his street. So again, as a party, we ran their own campaign. And I think maybe if there had been an actuary in central office, they might have looked at the risks, worked it out, suggested there would be other ways of doing things. Might not be the best way, but perhaps it wouldn't have been the way that we ended up. And we've obviously now got the challenges of a hung parliament. So, role of the councillor. the nuts and bolts. Speak with the people who elected you. Yeah, that means you've got to go back around and knock doors. I have a whole pile of leaflets sitting in the house at home. Our weather has been so bad recently, and because we live in the Edinburgh Alps, we have had quite a lot of snow, and it's been quite difficult getting the leaflets out. But it's also keeping an eye on local issues. So I have a special school in the constituency. Went to meet the parent council. They were getting funding cut for their summer play club. So these kids with some really severe disabilities, with fantastic staff, and the council was cutting their funding. So it meant that the parents were really going to struggle during summer holidays in terms of providing care. It's not a case of parents not looking after their kids. It's just really difficult for them because you're talking about severe disabilities. I'd gone to the special school nativity because you get invited to things like that. It was brilliant. The night before, I'd been to my daughter's school Christmas concert. And to be fair, the third orchestra, well, I'm glad there's not a fourth orchestra. But while parents and pupils and staff complained about the wrong note from the second violin, the next day, I had my world put right when you saw these kids with severe disabilities putting their all into a Christmas show. They're not going to win Britain's Got Talent, but they gave it their all. Local issues, local people, real day-to-day problems that affect them, and you've got to deal with it. The press, a photo in the paper works wonders. Always on the lookout for a photo op. Unfortunately, there are no Edinburgh Evening News journalists here tonight. Otherwise, this would have been great. But anyway. I might tell someone that did this. Use local papers for columns. It's just getting your message out there. And keep contact with influential journalists. I'm actually trying to think of an influential journalist in Edinburgh, but that's an issue. And the committee and the chamber. And this is where probably the application of actuarial skills becomes more relevant. First of all, be there. I had to miss one part of a council meeting. And what was hilarious, I'd been there to start. I nipped out, and they couldn't have missed me. I'd injured my foot and was on crutches. But the officials didn't realise I was there. I'd gone. I was only away for about an hour or so. And they thought I was still there and still voting. So they miscounted the vote. And it wasn't until someone realised after an hour of votes for appointments to committees that we were one member down. Anyway, bizarre. And read the papers. Let's go into that a little bit later on in more detail. Ask the pointed question. It's never the question you ask. It's what information you're trying to find out. They say that the best political question is the one that you already know the answer to. And that is true, because you can come back on the answer and query it. But really understanding what's the point. Some of my colleagues are very keen on standing up and talking. I'm not into that. I don't think there's any point. I think it's a waste of time. No one listens to council meetings anyway. We webcast them, and I think I know one person who watches the webcast. He's retired. There's nothing else to do. But that one person, 450,000 in the city. Propose relevant motions and amendments. So let me give you an example of that. In June, once we had an administration, and by the way, the Labour and SNP wouldn't form an administration until after the general election. Everyone knew what was happening, but they wouldn't announce they'd done a deal because they didn't want it to affect each other's votes in the general election. Shocking. Never get any behaviour like that in our party. They put forward their business plan for the city, and they came up with lots of measures as to how you would know whether they were successful. And one of the measures was, and I can't remember the exact detail was, but I think it was refurbish the athletic stadium by 2021, something like that. Their measure of success was refurbish the athletic stadium by 2021. So the measure was exactly the same as their objective. As you can imagine, an actuary had a little bit of fun going through a number of these very similarly worded objectives, which meant nothing, the lack of proper measurement in them, and suggesting that there could be some improvements. So we had the same thing in November. The administration came back, having done lots of work on their business plan for the next 5 years, now down to 4.5 years because it's taken them so long to get there. And they had exactly the same measures. So I put forward an amendment, and I and my colleagues again indulged ourselves and went through all 52 measures and explained why these 52 measures were inappropriate for the intentions of the... Now, that was an application... Now, not all of us are actuaries. Well, I'm the only actuary in the group. But we all used our professional training... Number of accountants, journalists, I'm trying to think what else we've got, IT specialists, but people used their professional training and went through these measures and applied effectively what we would describe as actuarial skills, applying reasonable assessment of whether these measures were appropriate. So it was fun putting forward that motion and explaining in words of one syllable why the administration was failing in its duty to the city. Now, amazingly, we got the Greens to support that. So we got a defeat on the administration, and that is coming back to committee in 10 days' time, 11 days' time, something like that, and I can't wait to get stuck into that because I'm on that committee, and I plan to go through it line by line. And the other thing, keep the politics to the chamber. In terms of how you behave, in committee, there's maybe an argument to be won, but committee is all about working together. And you will disagree on certain issues, but a lot of the time it does cross party political lines on committee. So there's actually an importance here in terms of how you behave as an individual, and in terms of how you respond to certain situations. That being said, I really don't like, maybe I shouldn't say this, I'm not the biggest fan of the council leader. And I think it's safe to say that he feels somewhat similarly disposed towards me. So I'm quite happy to have a go at him in the chamber. And I did a couple of weeks ago, and he took the hump and spoke to me the next day and said, why'd you say that? Oh, grow up. I did say that, actually. But in terms of how you behave with other councillors, treat them with respect. I think it's important. And the actuary's code is a very good way of actually dealing with opposition councillors, even if you disagree with them. I think it's really important that you do treat individuals as respect. I know there's been a lot of publicity recently about MPs who've said that they hate people from the opposite party and they would never have them as their friends. I think that's really quite sad. Because when you've got people like David Davis and the late Tony Benn, who could go on a national tour discussing politics on a stage to sell out audiences, crossing political boundaries, I think that showed a much better way of engaging in politics. So in committee, what's relevant? I've said read the papers again. People don't read papers. It's hilarious when they go into certain things. I was at the committee before Christmas, and the person I was quizzing said, "Oh, you have read your papers, haven't you?" I was quite pleased with that. It was in Appendix 2.1, so that was quite good. Now, actuarial skills, analyse the data. It's no different to what a good actuarial report should look like. I'll make reference to Martin again because he likes good actuarial reports. The best reports have all the facts and figures in the appendices, and they have a reasonably short body of a paper. That is the way that things are done in the council. So the key thing is just ignore what's written in the paper and go straight to the appendices, because that's the interesting stuff. And it's amazing the number of times that the data is not consistent with the conclusions of the paper. It's hilarious. But because people don't read the papers, they get away with it. Well, sometimes they get away with it. Not anymore. There's some information is overlooked, and you get inconsistencies expressed in what's said, and sometimes information is overplayed. A minor piece of information is blown out of all proportion, and you just don't get any balance in what's going on. And the final thing that is important is whether the papers are consistent with council policy. Whether you agree with the proposal of the policy, sometimes administrations will put things through in papers that are agreed that actually don't sit with, in our case, the 52 overall measures. But again, people don't read their papers. There's nothing there that the actuary can't do. Other professions can do it, but actuaries are perfectly placed to analyse the data. I assume that you would read your papers if you're representing to a board or sitting on a board. But to analyse the data, look at the conclusions to say, that's important, that's not important. It's amazing how often that is overlooked in politics, particularly in local government. And that's why people can get away with things that you then, as a voter, find unacceptable. So it's important that professionals participate in local politics so that type of skill can be used and applied to whatever the situation is. Just to give you a little idea of what I got up to, some really exciting stuff. The Lothian Valuation Joint Board is the most boring committee I have ever sat on in my life. We had a meeting last Monday, which lasted 45 minutes. We meet every 2 months. Don't even ask what it's about. It's so dull. It's awful. It has to fulfill a statutory purpose, but it's rubbish. Anyway, corporate policy and strategy. Now, that's the fun bit. So that really oversees everything that the council does. And I say everything. So if there are any policies that are changed, working policies that are changed within the council, they must come to CPNS where they're scrutinised. Any overall objectives that the council has, that's where you go through that as well. So that's where the 52 measures will be taken apart and debated, and hopefully we can defeat the administration on that paper. Another thing that's in vogue at the moment is city deals. I don't know if these are south of the border as well. Does anybody know? So there are opportunities for Treasury to provide allocation of specific money to projects that councils wouldn't otherwise spend it on. So the East of Scotland city deal is worth £1 billion. Edinburgh's portion of that's £600 million. So we get to scrutinise that. So we're talking about lots of money. lots of serious issues. We're getting some housing. We're getting a flyover at a roundabout. That's going to be jolly exciting because it's quite close to where I live and it's a real logjam. So that'll be quite nice from a personal point of view. Not that I engage in pork barrel politics. I'm an alternate member on our Governance, Risk and Best Value Committee. Now, this is where the actuarial skills kick in big style. Been able to look at what has happened in the past, look at what has gone wrong, and come up with solutions. And this is absolute. The actuarial skill set here is crucial because it's taken apart a complex problem, usually a complex mistake, doing the analysis on where that could be improved. And that the actuarial skill set is perfectly matched for that sort of issue. And just another couple of things. Welfare Reform Working Group, that doesn't really do very much. And that the last one's just a constituency issue. The MOD is selling off a lot of its estate. And Redford Barracks is a massive piece of land in my ward. So working on that. What can actuaries offer? Logical thinking is something that is notable by its absence in local politics. I sometimes am dumbfounded by the contributions that certain individuals make in the council chamber and in committee. It requires logical thinking, and I don't think the importance of local government, I'm talking about local government, all politics, local government, and the issues that local authorities deal with should be left to people who cannot think logically. And that is something that I would throw across all political parties. Too often we've got people who've been willing to knock on doors and smile in the past. Their reward is a council seat, usually in a safe seat as well. That's a disaster for local authorities. There are certain individuals on our council that when they stand to speak, the other 62 heads in the council chamber go down. And unfortunately, there are too many people like that. And it's a shame. And it's a reason why a lot of the problems in local authorities exist. Because there are people who cannot think logically and deal with massive problems. If you think of your own local authority and its budget, you're effectively electing people to run multi-million pound businesses. And your politics may say local government's not a business, and that's fine, that's okay, I understand that. But think of your own business and the skills that are required to reach the top of that business. But yet we're prepared to elect people who don't have those skills to deal with such similar budgets. Analytical skills, I've already touched on that. Looking at problems, dealing with them, coming up with solutions. Again, it's absent by its thinking. It's absolutely crucial. Strong questioning. We had a closed session, so I can't tell you what it was about, on the Governance, Risk and Best Value Committee. And I was sitting on the committee that day. I'd asked the supplier of the service to the council a large number of questions, probably too many. There are times to shut up. And I did my Columbo thing and said to the convener of the committee, and said, just one last question, convener. And I asked the question, and the answer was so bad, I had to indulge myself by saying, that was so bad, we need to ask an awful lot more questions. It's crucial. Actuaries have the skills to ask questions. And communication skills, again, I will repeat it, you've got them. We have them. The profession has them. We've got them all. So, opportunities. Okay, there were only a few hands went up in terms of being involved in local politics. It's not everyone's bag. I know everyone doesn't have a party political affiliation. That's fine. That's okay. There's no problem with that. Those of you who do, I would encourage you to get involved because you don't know where it would go. And there are opportunities. So I really, if you feel strongly about an issue or issues, join your local party. It's not expensive. it's really worth it. And I would say that to anyone, no matter their political persuasion. But there are other things like local committees. The number of schools that are looking for governors, the number of health authorities that are looking for individuals to serve on their board or also on other committees, the possibilities are endless. If actuaries, and I know everyone in the audience isn't an actuary, but we are one of the most respected professions in the country. If we are not prepared to use our skills for help running our local school, our local NHS trust, our local charity, whatever it is, then those organisations are going to suffer from having a deficit of knowledge. Now, that can be interpreted in an arrogant way, because other professionals can and do and also have skills that can provide. But the breadth of knowledge that the profession has, the members of the profession have, is such that everyone would be an asset to whatever they got involved in. There are also board positions, not just committees, paid positions that you can do, perhaps for people who are maybe greyer or flatter of head than some, but take the opportunity to get involved. They exist. There are loads and loads of opportunities locally. It doesn't have to be politics. The public sector is crying out for help in so many different ways. That's not any comment on the skills of people who are there. But for people who oversee what goes on in local authorities, in the public sector, actuaries provide the great opportunity of using knowledge and skills for the benefit of the community, benefit of society, and also the benefit of yourself. Because you will learn so much, you will get so much out of it, and there will be loads and loads of fun opportunity. And if you're sitting in opposition on Edinburgh City Council, frustration as well. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you very, very much, Paul. I'm sure we all learned something, and hopefully we can take something away to our day-to-day workplace. The floor is now open for some questions from you guys. If you can just make sure that you state your name and your fellowship status before you ask the question, that would be excellent. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Regina Poonian, and I'm a fellow. So you were talking about what actuaries can offer, and it sounds like you're saying that there's a lack of actuarial skills and actuaries in those positions. So what do you think's stopping actuaries from doing that so far, and how do we overcome that besides talks like these?
Two reasons. I think the obvious one is time. I think if we went back maybe 40, 50 years ago, you'd probably find that actuaries were much more active in their local communities because the demands of jobs weren't as sufficient, and employers were quite happy for people to walk out the door at 5 o'clock. That's the reality of the modern world. You have to make decisions. If you've got a family and you're working medium to long hours, you're not necessarily going to go off and help the local charity. So maybe it's something that you need to look at as you get older, as I did. Why do actuaries not get involved in politics? I think actuaries are, let me use the word to tempt a response, afraid of tribal politics. We are very good at, let me go down another stereotype on the one hand, on the other hand, but politics doesn't require that. Sometimes it is tribal. And yes, despite what I've said, I will be tribal in the council chamber when there's some point scoring to be had. And yeah, you do it. And you can't resist it sometimes. And I think as a group of individuals, as a profession, we're not really like that. I'm not sure whether that's the profession attracts individuals of a certain character that are maybe unwilling to be as tribal as a lot of politicians are. And I suspect a lot of you will be put off by a lot of the Yabu Sucks politics that goes on at PMQs, for example. I suspect some of you curled up in horror inside at the very thought of Trump's name being mentioned earlier. I think that's the way we are. Which is a wee bit of a shame, because I think more actors who got involved could make it less tribal.
Thank you.
Emma, there's a question. Two rows up from you, over there.
Julian Ellicott Fellow, and I'm the guy who had my hand up, so I am a sitting councillor. Funnily enough, when I joined a council a number of years ago, one of the other councillors on the other side of the chamber was John Previtt, who was a very decorated actuary, and we actually have another actuary now on the council as well. I'd just like to share a couple of observations and then lead to a question about the general election. I mean, certainly in my experience being on the council, I've had a lot of opportunities to apply my skills. It's amazing how many people don't grasp the basics of a discounted cash flow model. And, you know, quite seriously, there are occasions where different decisions could have been made because people don't quite realise the difference between capital and revenue and so on. I found also, you mentioned the Actuaries Code, which I think is very appropriate in some situations. For example, planning decisions, you have to go into meetings without predetermining a view, very non-political actually. And actually the ethics instilled through the Actuaries Code are very valuable in making sure that you approach those decisions in the right way. And a final example is actually quite apposite at the moment, it's even reached the mainstream press, is that a lot of councils are investing, borrowing money, investing in commercial property, looking at the current yield, thinking this is great, loads of revenue, without thinking through the risks, without thinking about the fact that those yields might not persist. So I would certainly support your call. We should be thinking ourselves of our public service duty and getting involved where we can. My question is about the manifesto, the Conservative manifesto. There were lots of people queued up, annoyed that they weren't involved in writing it. Apparently only two people wrote it. But given that there's a whole section in there about intergenerational fairness, and it was pretty obvious no actuaries went near it, what can we do, particularly with your involvement in the policy side of the profession, what can we do as a profession to make sure when the next manifestos of all parties come out, we have a way into those processes so that we can actually get the right kinds of sensible policy into those political manifestos, as well as complementing what the profession does into the professional, the Whitehall side of government?
Ooh, that's a difficult question. First of all, I'm glad that your observations are consistent with my experience to date as well. On the question, I think when council decided to set up a policy team within the employee structure of the IFOA, that was the problem they were looking at. Council at the time, and we're going back probably 6-7 years, couldn't understand why profession was responding to lots of consultations, but actually having zero influence, and I mean zero influence. And yes, you go back to the start of this decade and you look at the quality of the consultation responses, they're probably just the same as the quality of the responses that are done now. I suspect the English is maybe a bit worse, given that there was no policy team to oversee what was being written, but that's a separate issue. So the council took steps to do the right thing in terms of trying to get members of the profession more closely involved in what was going on in Whitehall, Westminster, Brussels. We've had some success. This is the last time I'm going to mention you, Martin, because three times in the night's too much. In November, Martin appeared before the Justice Select Committee to talk about our response to the Ogden rate. And then when the committee published its comments on the government's proposal, we were name-checked the whole way through it. I have never seen anything that had relied so much on what we had contributed before. When the Treasury Select Committee looked at insurance regulation about this time last year. We gave evidence. Andrew Chamberlain, chair of the Life Board, gave evidence to that committee. And I know that we were asked to help in the writing of the report that was eventually published. And when Parliament reformed, normally what happens with select committees, all the business is dropped. But the Treasury Select Committee chair, Nicky Morgan, said, this is something that's actually so important, we need to pick it up. Who was the first organisation that came to? It was us. So we're starting to change things. We're nowhere near where we can be. There's a limited amount of resource, obviously, that we can spend on this. And actually, the public affairs work shouldn't drive the profession. It should be part of what we do, but it shouldn't drive the profession. So we have to be careful with that. But we are now starting to be seen by some departments like DWP as go-to people when they're looking for technical analysis. But there's more to be done. Simon.
Thanks. Just want to be a bit provocative. I disagree with your answer to the last question. Actually, I disagree with quite a lot of what you said, Phil, but I'll focus on the last question. Where the IFOA was going wrong 10-plus years ago was that it was on the wrong side of the argument. So, for example, this is slightly less than 10 years ago. I forget exactly what the year was. But when the issue was gender-neutral insurance policies, actuaries were banging on about how, statistically speaking, that was the wrong thing to do, completely ignoring the public mood and the mood coming down from the EU, which ultimately was where the decision was being taken. Another one, which was around 10 years ago, was pension scheme transfer values. The methodology for calculating them was taken away from the profession and transferred to DWP through regulations. The profession got really up on its high horse because the profession insisted that as the Institute of Faculty of Actuaries, or at least the actuarial profession as it was then titled, was the expert in this, and that what DWP was doing was actuarially wrong, and the profession completely misunderstood the problem. They perceived it as an actuarial calculation rather than an issue of public policy. I won't go on, but there were others. There were other situations where, simply by being on the wrong side of the argument, they were bound to be ignored politically. Now, if you put yourself on the right side of the argument, and you have some expertise, people can then seize on you. So I don't wish to take anything away from Martin's performance, which I know nothing about, in front of the Select Committee. But the Ogden tables, they are an actuarial table. The change in interest rate was developed by the Government Actuaries Department. So having an actuary expressing a view on a matter that was developed by the Government Actuary, which was, as I understand it, different from what the Government Actuary had been saying, meant that those people who wanted to differ from the Government Actuary weren't faced with the argument, but the Actuary says such and such. It was, well, there's the Government Actuary and there's the Institute of Actuaries, and the people who wanted to choose the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries could do so. So I'm banging on at great length. It's about being on the right side of the argument rather than being on the actuarial side of the argument.
So I think the key thing on that is that the profession obviously has a public interest responsibility. It's written into our objects.
That's a misreading of the objects, by the way, but sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted.
Okay, we can talk about that later. It has been interpreted that we have a public interest responsibility. The difficulty is defining what the public interest means, and that is very difficult. So a simple example there is, and I know we have one organisation represented, if you look at the PRA, they're obviously looking at the stability of the whole financial sector. That's their responsibility. The FCA is looking at outcomes for individuals, basically. somewhere between those two, there has to be a balance. Because if you go exclusively to one, someone's going to lose out, either the stability of the sector or possibly individuals. So defining public interest when you've got a wide range of outcomes is very challenging. And when it comes to difficult issues like Ogden, believe me, there was a lot of debate, has been a lot of debate and will continue to be a lot of debate about what the profession's response should have said as opposed to what it did say. But it was taken with a lot of thought and recognising that there were different opinions. And I think there will always be different opinions. But it's going through the thought process. People, we just didn't sit around the corner and come up with an idea, oh, let's do that. We actually did go through a long process on Ogden and every other consultation in determining what the final position is. And it's not the staff that do it, it's the boards have ultimate responsibility. Our practice boards have ultimate responsibility for what's signed off. So I think the profession is very, very aware of its responsibilities in terms of what we do, what we say, how we say it. But there are things that have happened, certainly in my time there, where having conversations behind closed doors with officials saying, look, you've drafted something that will not work in practice, and here's the reason why it isn't going to work in practice, has led to changes in published regulation. It doesn't mean to say that we necessarily agree with what's been finally published, but being able to influence what is being discussed at high level is actually quite good for the profession, and it makes sure that we do the things that we should be doing.
There's a question just behind you over there, Emma.
Thank you. I'm Devin McDougall. I'm a student member, and just wanted to say thank you for that. It was really quite informative. You mentioned that throughout most of it, that being an actuary really prepared you uniquely for your role as a counselor. But what would you say was maybe the most out of your depth you felt in the role? And not in terms of like practicalities, but in terms of material and maybe coming to grips with something new.
I think, yeah, looking at what's happened over the last 9 months or so, for those of us who have come into this a little bit later in life, we're probably a little politically naive. And we'll say things that we probably shouldn't say because you get taken apart immediately. And that's just learning a new skill. And it's just adapting the realities of politics. It can be as simple as I said something that wasn't quite A, what I'd written down, and B, as watertight as it could have been. And unfortunately, the council leader in response just picked up on it and took me apart. And you learn. You don't do it again. But it's fine because there's only one person watching other than everyone else who was in the room. So that's the most difficult bit. New things that you've got to learn. I mentioned planning. I said I was not going to sit on the planning committee. I was adamant about that. But how things work, actually, is probably the biggest challenge. The stuff I'm on is quite high level, generic committee work. But once you get to transport and environment or education, then it becomes a lot more specific and you need to understand the nitty gritty. So part of it depends on what committees you sit on. And I suppose everyone's experience will be slightly different there.
Thank you. Oliver Pybus here, fellow. I'd like to echo thanks for the enlightening talk. It was interesting and slightly scary to hear you talk about how you've applied actuarial thinking or thinking to your role. I wondered whether you could perhaps outline how you've been prevented by applying actuarial thinking whether by the adversarial or cyclical nature of the, you know, the sort of council on which you serve?
That's a good question. This will be a personal view. I always think it's easier to deal with problems if you start with a number of high-level principles. I've really tried to avoid as much politics tonight as possible. I know there's some, but... So I haven't expressed what my political principles are, but I have certain principles, and then when I'm faced with a problem, I will apply those principles, whether actuarial or not, it doesn't really matter. I think it can be the same in any aspect of life. If you have certain principles and you stick to those principles, a lot of the time the solutions become really clear. So I wouldn't say that there's been any barrier presented by actuarial thinking. Sometimes it's maybe a little too easy to recognise the merits of the other side's case, which you shouldn't really do when you're trying to argue against it. So, for example, the trams. I remember someone during the camp. Actually, someone came to speak to me in the street stall. That's what it was. I do remember it. About the trams and what would be the positives of the trams. And I was able to explain why there would be a positive in terms of you provide transport to the north of the city and you then open that area for development because you've got links from that part of the city to the rest of the city, which you don't have at the minute, etc., etc., etc. That's the case for the trams. I ignored the cost until the end of the comment and said, but it comes at this cost and that's why I'm against it. So it probably just helps you see through problems if you start with those principles. But I don't think our actuarial thinking is a barrier.
I think we've got time for a couple more questions. We've got one in the front here. And then we'll go to the gentleman at the back there.
Thank you. David Simmons Fellow. My point, I think, follows from an earlier speaker, last but two, and it builds on your communication point, and I'd agree mostly in many areas where we're reasonably okay at communication, but one thing where I think we have a lot to do, or a lot to improve, is communicating with people who don't think as we do. And I think an even earlier person referred to there might have been a better outcome had a cash flow model been used. Now, that may well give a good outcome, but actually many people, if you mention that point, will think you're from some weird planet because that might be a natural way because of the work we do, the training we do to actually think of that, but actually people will look at you with a comment like, heavens, you're such an actuary if that's the way you want to kind of go about it. So I just really that one caveat about communication.
That's important. It is important. So where you can still use your actuarial thinking is in committee because you've got officials presenting reports alongside the political leadership, so you can quiz the officials who will have an element of expertise. So, for example, our treasury manager is first class. And there was quite an amusing moment in our Governance, Risk and Best Value Committee where I'd been discussing with the vice convener of the committee, who's one of the Green members, about credit risk. And I'm not clear if we do any analysis on credit risk. I said, I suspect we do, but there's nothing in this paper that indicates that's the case. She very unwisely decided that she would ask a question about credit risk in committee of her treasury manager, and she stumbled through the first half of the sentence, looked at me and said, perhaps Councillor Dogger could help finish the question. But actually what had happened was the treasury manager had already explained what credit risk was in simple terms, and there was no need to ask any questions about credit risk. She just didn't have a clue because she didn't understand. But it was understanding not to ask the question because it had already been answered in terms that actually, I was going to say the councillors understood, but one didn't. So it's a very valid point, but it's a case of using the technical language at the right time.
You mean at the back there, there's a question, yeah.
Okay, yes. Bryn Davis, I'm a fellow, and I've done my time in local government, stood five times, won the four, even did 4 years full-time as a councillor, so I have quite an experience. In terms of being an actuary, one of the interesting things was a certain degree of deference by potentially members, but officers were impressed that you were an actuary. And that does place a certain sort of responsibility on you and in relation to the profession. But my question is a more sort of practical one, which is how does it affect your career as an actuary? How do employers think about you adopting that sort of role? I was Labour. And that seemed to create a problem with some employers, and I just wondered how general, because it may be a bit different in Edinburgh, because, of course, Edinburgh Council is distinguished by having had an actuary as leader of the council in the past. I don't know if that makes any difference.
It'll depend on your employer. I've been quite lucky at the IFOA because one of the policies is that you get... I shouldn't tell you all this. You do get paid leave for community service and being a councillor counts for that. So, and the office is quite close to City Chambers in Edinburgh, so it wasn't difficult to nip up and alter your lunchtime or take that 10 days as part of your entitlement and use it. That's encouraged within the organisation. So as an organisation that encourages volunteering among its members, it's quite consistent with encouraging members of staff to volunteer as well in a particular way. I suppose it depends what you do, what you want to do. I said I could give a certain amount of time to do the role. I would love to do it full time, but £17,000 a year is not an actuary's salary. It's not most people's salaries. Some people do it full time. So we have a couple of retired people. With one mum who gave up work after a child was born and then decided to become a counsellor. So people will do it. I would be in favour of paying counsellors more, but having fewer of us, I think it would provide better opportunities for better counsellors in terms of fulfilling that role. You said something at the start. I was going to say something. I can't remember what it was, so I'll just ignore it. That's enough.
Excellent. Thank you. I know there were a few more questions from the audience, and hopefully you can all catch up with Philip at the networking drinks afterwards. In terms of the prizes, we've got Julian, who's a fellow and city councillor. Thank you for your contribution and encouragement. If you can come collect your prize afterwards. And then the student member, I didn't quite get your name, but I know you had a foreign accent. I'm allowed to say that. I'm foreign as well, so that's okay. Your question on what was the most out-of-depth Phil has felt before was quite good and created good conversation. So thank you for that. If you can come afterwards and come collect your prize, that would be good. And thank you again for your participation. And I'll draw the meeting to a close by thanking the speaker in the usual way.